There we go. Now we're set. Love technology. Hey, Joanne, thank you very much for inviting me. I so appreciate it. I really do. Hi, everybody. I'm Pat. I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I'm glad to be here with you guys tonight. A lot of you guys are in New York, right? I mean, raise your hand if you're in New York or East Coast. East Coastism, right? 11 o'clock at night, and you guys are up for me. You guys are like mad dogs. I mean, this is incredible. So good for you guys. I understand that I get a chance to speak to you guys for a little bit, and you know, it's experience, strength, and hope. And I want to give you just a little bit of my background, so you know where I'm coming from. And then I want to spend most of the evening, as far as what I get a chance to share with you guys about, is this program, this recovery, what the solution is. Hope you guys don't mind. I'm going to major in the solution, not the problem. That's okay. So, quick background. You know, I started drinking when I'm 14 years old. It saved my life. Bottom line, it saved my life. I was had a messed up childhood. I had a lot of stuff going on that did not make me an alcoholic. It just meant that when I found alcohol, it was a lot bigger solution than, you know, and I could have found anywhere else. You know, I thought my brother was my cousin was my cousin, but he turned out to be my brother. Mom, through alcoholism and addiction, we lost our baby sister. She died. Dad was a hard drinker, but you know, it was, he could pull it off, stopping when he had to stop. And so what I learned in my family early on was, you don't tell people the truth about what's going on. You hide out, you avoid telling anybody anything of substance, and you don't trust anybody. Anybody else have that kind of a thumbs up, kind of a background kind of thing? So there's a few of you on here, I think. So there, when I discovered alcohol, it was Mickey's Big Mouth. And, you know, I was off the races from day one. It was on. And, you know, I was going through high school, and from day one, it was pretty intense. And by my senior year in high school, my coach called me aside and he said, "Pat, no one can pronounce another person an alcoholic, but you might want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't, I think you're probably going to die." Now, that's a pretty big statement when you're only 17 years old. And I said, "Coach, thanks for the information. Appreciate that. But thank you very much." And so I'm going through my senior year of high school. And by the end of my senior year of high school, I'm thinking, you know what? I've got to get off this crazy train, because I hadn't been sober a whole lot since 14. A lot of blackout drinking, a lot of consequence already. And so I give my life to God. A friend of mine said to me, "If you give your life to God, you're going to, the stuff that's going on in your head, Pat, it'll probably get better." And so give your life to God. So, you know, we grew up with the Young Life kind of stuff in Littleton, Colorado. I give my life to God. And wouldn't you know it, guys? From April of my senior year in high school till August, my freshman year going to college, I didn't drink. That was the longest period of drinking, not drinking, I had had since I was 14 years old. So April, May, June, July, August, five months, I'm not drinking. I get up to the first night of college, and I'm a little bit uncomfortable in my skin. We're going to talk a lot more about that here in a bit. And I thought, you know what? It's been 5 months since I've drank. You know, they have this kegger party at the dorm, but I don't feel like I belong. I don't feel like I fit in. I'm going to have one beer. I know. I'm just going to have one beer. I'm going to control this thing, and it'll be just fine. Well, I wake up where I don't belong the next day, and I didn't even understand this going on, but the allergy hit me that night. I didn't even understand what this physical allergy of the disease was yet, because I hadn't gotten any Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I can't control it. And it starts hitting me, and the obsession is kicked in. And all of a sudden, my freshman year in college and my dream of becoming a veterinarian is out the window, and they asked me to leave college. I can't even complete the year. I discovered grain alcohol. I discovered white lightning. It's called Everclear in Colorado. And man, that stuff got me to where I wanted to go pretty quickly. You have to be careful with it, because it'll make you go blind if you're not careful. And so there was a couple times where I wake up and I couldn't see, and then, you know, it comes back. But that is sort of the way that I drank. That's sort of what kind of stuff happened. It was always pretty big. Now I'm going to fast forward to the end of my story. the last 10 years of my drinking, I'm 65. I got sober when I'm 43. So God struck me sober on July the 9th, 2002. And I emphasize God struck me sober. I had nothing to do with it. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. So it's 1991. I'm in another new job and I'm pretty good at sales. And I win this contest and we go to Hilton Head Island over in the East Coast. And I'm uncomfortable in my own skin. In this period of time, in 1991, I've been trying to quit, not trying to quit, trying to quit, not trying to quit for a bunch of years. But now I'm really serious. And I remember getting on the plane before I went to Hilton Head and I said, I'm not going to drink. I had been sober for about 3 months. And I go, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I know what kind of stuff happens. I'm not going to drink. Well, you know what happens. So I get to this Hilton Head Island. I get to this party of the evening and the president of the New York Stock Exchange is there. The head of our company's there. There's a bunch of big wigs there. And I'm uptight. You know, I grew up with nothing. I didn't have a whole lot of stuff going on. And I was always intimidated by money. I was always intimidated by people with power. I was always intimidated by smart people because I thought I was a dumb guy and I couldn't learn. I had a lot of self-defeating beliefs. And so my manager looks over me and says, hey, Pat, take a drink. Why don't you have a Tanqueray on the rocks? You'll take the edge off. You'll be just fine. And I thought, that's a great idea. So I have the Tanqueray on the rocks. And off to the races I go. And the next thing I know, I'm butt naked, staring at the new president of the New York Stock Exchange, bent over saying, kiss my butt. You need me more than I need you. I mean, it's just craziness, folks. We do crazy things when we get drunk. Now, none of that makes me a drunk. It makes for some lively stories. And I had much more to go into. But the bottom line is it set me off on another alcoholic run that I didn't even know was coming. I was just going to have one Tanqueray on the rocks. And this time the progressiveness of our disease hit me hard. 1991 to 2002. It's sort of a mystery to me. I go to work, I do the deal, but I'm drinking and drinking and drinking. And now I'm starting to lose things. I lost my first wife through my alcoholism. I lost my second wife through alcoholism. I lost my three children through alcoholism. I lost my business through the alcoholism. I lost my health through the alcoholism. And doctors are telling me, if you don't slow down, if you don't stop, your liver's hit, you're not going to make it. This is bad stuff. Thank you for the information, doctor. See, guys, that was frothy emotional appeal to a real alcoholic. It wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to lose wife and kids and family. It wasn't enough to lose business and health. And, you know, I still slur a little bit, you know, even to this day. And I have Barrett's esophagus and a few other things as a, you know, sort of the helper, you know, from doing all the stuff I did. And by the time 2002 comes, I've got a decision to make. It's either going to be suicide or getting sober. And I remember the last few years, I remember distinctly, again, no Alcoholics Anonymous in me. And I was, what I had concluded on my own journey was that every time I touched alcohol, I couldn't control how much I drank. I didn't know what you guys meant when you call that a physical allergic reaction to the drink, because I'd never been to any of your meetings. But I knew that to be a truth for me. And so I concluded that the only way I'm going to be able to live is to not ever drink again. And so then I think I could pull that off. And I'd look in the mirror in the morning. I'd tell myself, I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to drink. And the next day or that next night or the next afternoon or the next morning, I'm drinking. And I'm drinking against my will. I'm not drinking any longer to get a high. I'm not drinking any longer to feel comfortable. I'm not drinking any longer. I'm drinking because I have to drink. And I'm getting scared now. I'm getting really scared because I can't control this thing. And I feel like somebody's put a gun to my head and I got my own finger on the trigger. And I'm the one slowly squeezing the trigger to kill myself with my alcoholic drinking. I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't figure out why I can't stop. It doesn't make any sense. I have willpower in other areas of my life, but I don't have any willpower here. What's wrong with me? And so I'm puzzled. And I remember one night, and the lights are off. I'm all alone now, and I'm drinking Grey Goose out of the refrigerator. I'm just drinking out of the bottle, and I'm thinking, I'm going to die this way. I'm going to die this way. This is what's going to happen to me. I'm going to die. And now I'm beyond fear. I'm beyond the understanding of conscious torture. And now I'm just feeling like, when's the end going to come? When's the end going to come? And I have another bad, one of the things that I did when I was drinking, every time I drank, I ended up sleeping with women that were not my wife. That's a bad thing to do if you're trying to stay married. You know, you just shouldn't make that a habit. And another event happens. It's 4th of July, sometime between the 4th of July, 2002, 4th, 5th, 3rd, 2nd, somewhere in there. I don't know exactly, because I'm sort of all a mess. But I do it one more time. And this time my wife catches me, and she meets me at the door with the woman that I just slept with across the cul-de-sac. And she said, did you sleep with? And I said, no, I didn't. I go to bed and I think I'll figure this thing out once I sober up. And about 5 minutes later, I feel my feet being knocked at the bottom of the bed. And it's my wife, and she had gone across the street to the cul-de-sac, got the woman, came back into the house at the foot of the bed and said, did you sleep with her? And I looked at the girl I just slept with. I'm looking at my wife, and I said, no, I didn't. Blah, blah, blah. I lie. She lies. But my wife knows the truth. And there was something at a core level, incomprehensible demoralization for about the 3,000th time. And I said, in my mind, I said, I'm either going to commit suicide or I'm getting sober. But this kind of stuff is never going to happen again. It doesn't really matter what your event is in your lives. But at some point, we have that incomprehensible demoralization. And it kills us. It tanks us. Bill had it, and he calls it quicksand stretched out in every direction. You know, his life was with this self-pity and this misery, and he wanted to make it right with Lois, and he couldn't do it anymore. And I'm feeling a little bit of like that kind of stuff. And so I get honest for the first time in years. I've been seeing a therapist. You know, I'm seeing doctors. I'm seeing psychologists. I'm seeing psychiatrists. I'm seeing self-help gurus. I'm seeing anybody, folks, that will help me get sober and keep me sober, and none of them are working. So I go to this gal that I've been seeing, and she's a social worker, but she had a specialty in marriage. And I told her the truth for the first time. I said, Sally, I can't stop drinking. She said, I know. I said, why haven't you said anything in all these years? Because it's up to you to bring it up, not me. And it was like she had been waiting for this statement for me for years. And she said, Pat, and listen to the words. No one can pronounce another person alcoholic, but you might want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Anderson, this is for you. She said, go to the Dragon's Den. They have meetings every day, and they have meetings starting at 6:45 in the morning. And you're going to find your answer, because Pat, you're, in my opinion, and you got to be the judge of it. I think you're a real alcoholic. And if that's true, there is nothing that I can do for you. Dr. Silkworth said the same thing to Bill. Roland Hazard heard the same thing from Dr. Young. You know, it's an amazing thing when the humility of an educated person, a professional, says, I do not have the solution. And they direct us into Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless those people for having that kind of humility. And so I went over to what I called my adopted mom, because my real mom wasn't much, you know, it was a hard relationship. And I remember talking to Claudia, like my adopted mom. And I got over there early in the morning, and I think it was the 7th or the 8th or 9th. I don't know. I called July 9th my sobriety date, because that's the first day I could remember. And I walked into Claudia's house and I said, Claudia, I'm either going to commit suicide or I'm going to get sober. And I don't really hold out a whole lot of hope for getting sober, but I'm going to try this thing one time with this Alcoholics Anonymous group. In fact, I called it the A&A group. I didn't even know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I called it the A&A group. And so I go rolling into this meeting. And this gal at the this in the Dragon's Den, it meets in this really cool old clubhouse kind of place. And it wasn't a very big meeting. There was maybe 30, 40 people in the meeting. And it was a 5:30 in the afternoon meeting. I remember that much. And I don't remember a whole lot of people saying anything, but they go around the room. Ann says, I'm an alcoholic. Malibu, Surrey, BC says, I'm an alcoholic. You know, Katie says, I'm an alcoholic. Joanne says, I'm an alcoholic. Well, they get to me and I say, I'm Pat, and I don't know what I am. I have no idea what I am. And it was like bees to honey. It turned into a first step meeting and a qualification meeting. And this gal named Thalia, who I remember this day, she's probably in her early 60s. And she looked at me from the other end of the table. And it was like lasers to my eyes. And I could barely keep my eyes open. I'm shaking because I hadn't had a drink in a few days and it's bad. And they wouldn't give me a cup of coffee, folks. They would not give me a cup of coffee because I kept spilling it because I couldn't hold the thing. And she looks at me, lasers in her eyes, and she says, "Pat, if you will do what we've done, you're never going to have to feel the way that you feel tonight ever again." And there is just enough belief in what she said to me. She had such conviction, and she was offering hope to me that I believed her. And so I start my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, here's the deal. My grand sponsor said, "Sobriety without solution is cruelty, and solution without love is brutality." Now, I'm starting my journey of sobriety, but I do not have a solution. And inside of a couple months, I am suicidal, even worse, and I'm homicidal, even worse. See, one of the parts of my stories is I almost took out a contract on my first ex-wife because of things going on. And I'm not exaggerating about that. I mean, it was the next moment out of my mouth would have declared whether that person was going to live or die. And that's a scary place to get to, a dark place to get to in your life. And that's what that's where I was at. And I was more suicidal and more homicidal in my life because I didn't have alcohol to numb my reality. I didn't have anything to take me into oblivion. I didn't have anything to stand between me and myself. And I am dying. But I'm going to the 6:45 a.m. meeting every single day, and I couldn't work anymore. And so I'm going to 3 meetings a day, every single day, 7 days a week for the first year of my sobriety. I can't work. And I'm watching this guy that came in named Aaron, and Aaron has the same kind of background that I had, the same kind of low bottom, the same kind of everything, but Aaron's getting better, folks. Aaron is getting better. This guy he's lighting up, and he's starting to talk about the book, and he's talking about the allergic reaction to the drink. He's talking about the mental obsession. He's talking about this weird thing called a spiritual malady, unmanageability, untreated alcoholism, present-day agnosticism, and I have no earthly idea what he's talking about. I have no idea. And so I pull him aside after the meeting one morning. I said, "Aaron, who's your sponsor?" Because, see, I had picked out my own sponsor. My first sponsor, folks, was drunk. He was supposedly sober for 10 years, but he was on the sly drinking. He wasn't sober at all. We tried to do a fourth and fifth step, and he's so tired of listening to me. He says, "Pat, just go on. You're good." I go, "I'm good. What do you mean?" He said, "Tom, aren't there steps 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12? And he goes, "Yeah, there are, but don't worry about it. You'll figure it out." That was my first sponsor, guys. I mean, if God strikes us sober, God strikes us sober. It's not a human power. It's not a sponsor. A sponsor doesn't keep me sober. And so I say to Aaron, I said, "Aaron, who's your sponsor? I've got to meet this guy." And Aaron says to me a really loving and caring, wonderful thing. "No way. I'm not telling you who my sponsor is. I know what you're like, and you'll try to dominate him. You'll try to take all of his time. I won't have any time." He wouldn't tell me the name of his sponsor, folks. He wouldn't tell me. So I go on a Dick Tracy mission, and I go hunting around for him. I follow Aaron to every meeting, and finally, after a couple of weeks, I found out who Aaron's sponsor was. His name was Bill T, and I got a hold of Bill T. I'm about 3 months sober, and I said, "Bill, I don't know what you're doing with Aaron, but I want you to do it with me because I'm dying, and I'm not exaggerating. I'm not a drama guy, guys. I'm not. But I said, I'm dying and I'm going to kill myself if I don't figure this thing out. And I'm not figuring it out. And this is torture. This is absolute torture." And Bill, God bless him, agreed to sponsor me. And he took me on this road of going through the work the way I go through the work, the way I've been taking people through the work for the last 20 plus years. I started sponsoring people when I was 6 months sober, maybe a little earlier than that. And I've never not had sponsees in all the time since. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. I wouldn't trade that incredible revolutionizing experience when you watch another soul that's dead wake up to the living God of the universe and have a life-changing event. And they start living in the sixth they have a sixth sense and they start living there in a fourth, the fourth dimension of reality. They start living there and you start seeing the great fact of their life on page 25 coming true. Their whole attitude about life and about God's universe, their whole attitude about themselves, about you and I starts changing. And the central fact, we start seeing it, that their lives are changing by a power that they couldn't muster up themselves. See, we lack power. That's our dilemma. We got to find a power bigger than us. And this way that Bill T took me through the work revolutionized my life. I didn't know the big book. I had my, after Tom, my first sponsor, I started hanging out with a retired goalie in hockey who was about 65 years old, and his name was Buddy, and he was a great guy, and he took me on 12-step calls almost every night, and he knew the love of God, and he knew, but he wasn't a really a big book guy, but he was just a 12-step guy. It's sort of a crazy thing, but he had been hit a couple times by the hockey puck because he worked, he was a hockey player in the era where there was not a mask, so, and he was a goalie, so it was a little bit sketchy. But Bill T took me through the work and he started turning statements into questions for me. And he took me on the cover page and said, Pat, this is a story of 1,000 of us that have recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. Recovered, not recovering, recovered. We recover mind and body. We're not going to be the same any longer. And we are going to grow in our spiritual understanding and our spiritual life for the rest of our lives. That's a day-to-day occurrence. And if you'll do what I've done, you're going to have what I've got. And I was all in. He was a parole officer. I sort of related to the guy a lot. And he was hardcore. And we did the deal. It took us about 6 months to go through the work. And he said, he held up his big book to me. And he did one of these kind of things. I got the thin big book, right? And here it is. Here's all the pages of the thin big book. And he took it like this. And he took, he said, the instructions for going through the work are in the first 103 pages. And he said, and here's the deal. This is worth a little bit of time. He said, I want to show you something, Pat. Here.
You got muted for some reason.
Thank you. Yeah. Probably I should have shut up anyway. So anyway, two sides of pages, and they're roughly the same size. And thank you for unmuting me. Appreciate it. He said, Pat, on the left side, those pages that were almost equal in number is all step one activity. It's all step one. And the other half of the pages, Pat, are steps 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. What does that tell you, Pat? Well, Bill, I'm not a rocket scientist, but I'm guessing that step one is pretty important. He said, you got it. And here's my conclusion out of my step one experience in all these years. And by the way, how in touch am I in my step one? Every day. Every day. Because alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and I am no match for it. God stands between me and the drink. There's no doubt about it. But I don't ever forget that this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It held me down. It had me out for the count. And so I start going through this work in step one, and my conclusion is this. I absolutely will drink. My conclusion to step one is I will absolutely drink. Wait a minute, Pat, that sounds crazy. You know, we're in Alcoholics Anonymous. Step one is supposed to, you know, show us the hopelessness and the hope. Yeah, I get that. But the truth of step one is if I'm a real alcoholic, I don't have power over control of how much I drink when I drink. That's what Dr. Silkworth tells me. I'm of a distinct class that it never happens to the average temperate drinker. When I pick up a drink, I have an allergic reaction to the drink and I drink, and I drink more than I want to drink, and I don't have any control over how much I drink. That's the conclusion of physical allergy. And then the mental obsession, the conclusion, the mental obsession is there is no power in your life or humankind, Pat, that could stop the strange mental blank spot that is total insanity that throws you into the drink every single time when you're stone cold sober. Isn't that what Fred's story tells us? Isn't that what Jim's story tells us? Isn't that what the Jaywalker story tells us? Isn't that what Carpet Slipper Man's story tells us? Isn't that what Bill's story tells us? Isn't that what Dr. Bob's story tells us? Isn't that what Roland Hazard's story tells us? Isn't that what Abby Thatcher's story tells us? Yeah, I could stop, but I can't ever stay stopped. I couldn't stay stopped. And page 44 sums up in the first paragraph the previous four chapters. Dr. Silkworth, the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, more about alcoholism, right? And in We Agnostics, the first page of 44, it says this, Pat, if when you drink, you have little control, or when you're not drinking, you have little choice in picking up that drink, you're probably an alcoholic. And if that's the case, you got to find a spiritual way of life or you're going to die. Now, here's the other part of my story, guys. I'd given up on God. I was not neutral in coming into this room. I didn't want a gosh dang higher power. I didn't want God. I didn't want any of that mumbo jumbo spiritual garbage. That's what I thought about that whole realm, because I'd spent money, energy, time, and effort for a decade plus trying to find a solution. It was not working. And Bill T, my sponsor, said to me, Pat, tell me about your spiritual orientation. I said, spiritual orientation? What do you mean? He said, well, look up on that board. I look up the board and I see this step three thing, and it's talking about God. And I'm saying, wait a minute, Bill, are you telling me that this Alcoholics Anonymous, these 12 steps, is all about me having a relationship with God? And he looked at me with sort of a wink in his eye, and he did not back off. He didn't apologize for God. He didn't say, oh, don't get scared, Pat. Don't. He said, yes. Yes, it is. And he took me over to page 29 of the text, and he said, take a look. The whole purpose of the stories, Pat, is to show us how we establish our relationship with God. That's the purpose of the stories. And Pat, the second half of Bill's story is all about God, running from an impersonal God that had no power in his life to a personal God experience that had all the power in his life that separated him from alcohol for the rest of his life. Now, let me ask you a question, Pat. Are you open to a possibility of having your life recreated? I go, yeah, I want my life recreated. I don't want what I got. He said, then you're going to be open to spiritual terms as well. And what I'm going to ask you to do is set aside your prejudice about what you think about spiritual terms. And for the first time in your life, I want you to honestly ask yourself, what do they mean to you? And you know what? He gave me a prayer. And you guys probably know it. A lot of people in the Bronx knows it, I'm sure, because I see it on the screen when I've been there. But it's the set aside prayer. And he said it to me. He said, Pat, let's ask God. I said, are you telling me you're going to pray with me right now? I said, oh, yeah. And by the way, guys, I pray with all my sponsees from day one. They don't even believe it. I don't care. We pray. He said, Pat, here's what we're going to do. God, please set aside in Pat everything he thinks he knows about you, himself, AA, the 12 steps, and especially spiritual terms, so he may have an open mind for a new experience in all these things. Amen. He said a prayer for me, folks. It saved my life. And I don't know how to describe this, but all of a sudden I became open to the possibility of a God relationship. I didn't believe it, but I had lost the anger. I'd lost the hatred. I'd lost the, God, you didn't do anything for me kind of thing. And I became open. And so I go through the step one experience, and I find out I'm powerless over control and choice of this drink, and that I have this thing called a spiritual malady. See, in the rooms, I always heard that it's a mental obsession. It drives me back to the first drink. And Bill said to me, Pat, that's not true. It is not the mental obsession that drives us to the drink. What are you talking about? He said in step four, it tells us that when the spiritual malady is overcome, I straighten out mentally and physically. So you see, Pat, what's really driving the train is your spiritual condition. And you're in a spiritual malady, and you're sickened in spirit. And the Oxford group, which is what Bill got involved with, that's what Ebby got involved with, that's what Roland got involved with, they had what was called soul surgery. And you and I are going to go through soul surgery. We're going to find out if you need a power bigger than you in step two. So he took me through my step two experience, and he said, can you see the insanity now of you trying to live on your own power, trying to resist controlling the drink, trying to resist making a choice to not pick up the drink, trying to figure out life experience? See, he also took me through a thing called an unmanageability exercise. It's a fancy word. And that we, and I do with my sponsees, but it's really, you know, there's seven other inventories in the big book besides the four-step inventory. There's seven other inventories. So he took me to page 18 for the alcoholic illness inventory. And he said, let's look at your annihilation of spiritual relationships, Pat. In that first paragraph on page 18, it talks about the annihilation of my relationship with other people. It talks about sad wives and blameless children being harmed and hurt by what I've done. And he asked me, he said, tell me about your relationships. And I said, I don't have any. They're good. He said, you have no relationships. You're calling that good? That's not the way it's supposed to be. He said, tell me about how your kids feel about you. And they said they never want to see me ever again in their natural lives. That's a hard thing to hear, folks. They're not even old. They never want to see me again. My two ex-wives, polar opposites in who they were, neither one of them ever wanted another thing to do with me. My business partners never wanted another thing to do with me. He took me over to page 52 in these bedevilments, and he said, let's take another look at the spiritual malady. This is not the spiritual malady, Pat, but these are signs of the spiritual malady. I go, okay. He said, on page 52, they're called the bedevilments. And he said, tell me about your personal relationships. Again, from page 18, we talked a little bit about it. But he said, I want to hear about the problems you've had in your relationships. And I started enumerating some of those problems. And I go, wow, I can't solve any of those things. And he said, well, tell me about your emotional nature. Now, Pat, your emotional nature isn't your stage character that I see you put in on half the mornings at 6:45 meeting because you're trying to look like the good guy. And everybody knows that you're blown up. Everybody knows that you're broken. Everybody knows. But you're trying to convince the world that you're not. He said, tell me about your emotional nature. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, those are the voices when you're waking up in the morning that tell you whatever they tell you. And I said, well, my voices tell me I'm no good. I'll never amount to anything. I'll never repair the damage. I'm a piece of garbage. You know what? I deserve to die. That's my emotional nature. That's what's going on inside my voices in the morning. Anybody ever heard those voices? They sort of travel across the country back and forth a few times. And so these voices are off in my head. I call them the 12 monkeys. These little midget monkeys are just nailing me every morning. And I can't control them. And my emotional nature is something deep down inside. To you, this on a stage character, I smile and I act like everything's fine. But underneath the surface, I'm going, I want to kill that person. That person offended me for the last time. I'm going to take them out. I don't know how I'll do it, but I'm going to get even with them. I'm going to get back at them. And I can't control what's going on inside of me. And then he said, how are you doing with misery and depression? He said, tell me about you making a living. I said, I can't make a living. I'm unemployed. He said, yeah, but let's assume for a second you get a job again. And did money, when you were making the big bucks, did that ever solve all the problems? I go, no, it didn't. Didn't matter how much, it was never enough. And I wasn't satisfied. I wasn't happy. He said, wouldn't it be great if you found a way to be able to do that? That no matter what you're doing, you could be actually satisfied and joyful about what you're doing. So how about misery and depression, Pat? What do you think about the world? You have a cynical view of the world, a caustic view of the world. You have sort of a negative view of the world, like it just sort of stinks and it's just dog eat dog. We just got to hang in there. Yeah. Isn't that the way it is? Says, no, that's not the way it is. It's God's world and God can change things. And then he said, how about your view of depression? I said, Bill, I've been suffering from depression since I'm 14 years old. I got a lot of depression. I think that's just the way I have to live. He says, you don't have to. Then he said, tell me about fear. Tell me about unhappiness. Tell me about being lack of real help to other people. Tell me about being useless. And we go through all these bedevilments and I go, oh, I can't change any of this stuff. And he said, if you don't have any more power than you do right now, that's the stuff that's driving you to suicide. Do you understand that? That these bedevilments, this spiritual malady, this lack of ability to manage your life, and your lack of ability to access God's power, that's what's destroying your life. Do you see the insanity of trying to live with your head and your heart and your soul in a world that says you're better off dead? It's insane. You can't pull that off. Do you want a way out? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, then, you know what? Cornerstone decision. Are you willing to believe that God's big enough to handle you? Are you willing to believe? I don't care what your concept of God is, Pat. By the way, Pat, you're not going to invent God. That is not what the book says. You're going to give your own concept of what God has revealed to you about God. It is not invent your God, Pat, because when the chips are down, you don't want to go to a man-made creation of God. You want to go to God who's put his idea of who God is deep down in your soul. That's what's going to save your life. So, Pat, what's your conception? I go, I don't have a conception. I used to think that God was accessible. I thought that God could help me, and I can't find God. He said, well, what's your conception of a friendship? And I said, well, I haven't had one for a while, but I started to give them some ideas. And he said, Pat, here's why I ask you. Bill Wilson was in the same boat. And he had to form a relationship with God also that was personal, because an impersonal God experience is not enough. Knowing about God was not enough for Roland Hazard. Knowing about God for Bill was not enough. It wasn't enough to have a God that was big as the universe. It wasn't enough that God is God, that Bill's God was outside of time and limitation. That wasn't enough for Bill because it did not solve his problems. You know what started solving his problems, Pat? It was his ability to be open to the possibility of a personal God experience. He wasn't open to it at first because Ebby introduced that thought to him, and he called it a personal God that is loving, powerful, and guiding. A God that loves you, a God that is powerful in you and actually wants to be with you, Pat, actually delights in you, actually wants to spend time with you, waits at the foot of your bed for you to wake up in the morning so he can spend all day long with you and take you on adventures of who God is all day long for the rest of your life. That's who God is. And he said, Bill understood for the first time that God was his newfound friend. And Bill connected to God as his newfound friend. Pat, what is your conception of God now? And I said, newfound friend, what would that be? Well, I'd want a God that believes in me and wants to be with me and likes me. Okay, that sounds like a good one. I'd want a God that is faithful and loving and powerful. I'd want a God that was directing, that I could understand, that he could give me, he could have my back, that he could get me through the tough times, that he could make my life worth living. I'd want a God that would, I want a newfound friend that would hang with me when I'm sad, when I'm blown up, and not try to lecture me. I'd want him to just love me and be with me. I want him to walk on a path with me and not say anything for 5 miles. And then maybe only a sentence or two. Then other times I'd want him to interrupt me and tell me the truth, even though I don't want to know the truth. I'd want a God that always told me the truth and loved me enough to tell me the truth. And Bill says, where do you think you got those ideas? I said, I have no earthly idea. And Bill told me in step two, we agnostics, said the fundamental idea of God has been poured into your heart. That's where you got those ideas. God already put himself in your heart with the idea about who God is. And you know what, folks? I had this much more belief, this much more faith in what he was saying that it was possible. And then we go into our step three experience. And how much time do I have? I'm getting too excited. I know only like 5 minutes, Joanne, or four, or two, one. Put your hand up. I can't see you.
10.
10? Oh, yay, 10 minutes. You guys are stuck with me for 10 more minutes. I hope that's okay. Thumbs up. We're good? Right? All right. All right, here we go. Third step decision. I had to see that my life lived on self-will was a tire fire. I had to see that I was in breakage of everybody, flooding out, breaking things, chaos. I was a producer of confusion. I was not a producer of harmony. I stepped in the toes of my fellows and they retaliated. You know what? I couldn't get out of my own way. I could not punch myself out of the bag I was in. And Bill took me through that step three inventory of that experience of the drama of, you know, what's going on when I'm on self-will. Then he said, you know, here's the fundamental decision. It's called the keystone decision. The cornerstone decision was I'm willing to believe there's a power bigger than me that could save my life. I got there. And then the second part of the cornerstone decision is God going to be everything in your life going forward, Pat, or is God going to be just an additive, or is going to be nothing? Because, Pat, there's only one alternative. He's either everything or he's nothing. What's your choice? I said, I want everything. I can't manage my life. And he said, okay, keep that thought. And so we go into that third step and we do that drama exercise where I turn everything into my first person. So I'm saying, Pat's the one trying to arrange lights. Pat's the one trying to get his way. Pat's the one is trying to be more kind, more wonderful, but it's not working. Pat, can't you see that you're into the delusion, that you're trying to wrestle satisfaction, happiness out of this life? If you only manage it well, and you don't have the ability to manage it well. You're not a manager, Pat. You're a follower. And you got the role reversed. Your job's to follow, not to lead. It's God's job to lead. I said, Bill, what if God won't lead? I can't hear him. I don't know how to feel him. I don't know how to touch him. And the book keeps talking about where we see, feel, believe, experience. We get a guidance. We get all this stuff. And Bill, I don't see how that's going to happen in my life. I said, stay tuned. It's going to happen. He said, Pat, from now on, I want you to have a new attitude. I heard about your life with your mom and your dad. I heard about your experience with father figures. I heard about your abuse with the church and the sexual abuse that you experienced. I heard about all the stuff that you've experienced. But you know what? You could have a new father. And he'll protect you. He'll love you. He'll care for you. He'll guide you. He'll watch over you. Do you want a father like that? And I said, yeah, I do. And see, now my spirit's starting to get soft. See, Pat, how about some guidance and some direction? How would you like a new director in your life? I go, yeah, I would. Pat, later on in the steps, in 11th step, you're going to pray every day for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out. That's going to be pretty cool. You're going to experience things you won't even believe. Because remember back in page 49, Pat, when we're reading We Agnostics, it says you're going to be his intelligent agent, a spearhead of God's ever advancing creation. That's for the real. You could take that to the bank. He's going to use you in ways you don't even have an idea that's going to happen. It's going to be unbelievable. I go, I want that. He said, God's going to be your principal too. He's not going to call you to do things that you don't have the power to do. He's going to give you the power to do the work that he sets out. A principal is the authority. And his agent is given the authority to act on behalf of the principal. And you have God's authority. You have God's power. You can change people's, by letting God use you, God can change people's lives. It can never be changed otherwise. See, we talk about experience, strength, and hope in this room. The hope is all about what we get to give to other people, like Thalia gave to Pat back in 2002. If you will do what we've done, you'll never feel the way you feel. And I go, God, please do that in my life. Do that in my life. He said, Pat, you have a new creator. You have a creator that you were never in touch with. He's personal. He knows every hair in your head. He knows every beat of your heart. He knows every breath you take. He knows every thought before you think it. And he's answering your prayers before you even speak them. You don't have to beg God to be with you. He's there by choice. He was rescuing you before you even knew who he was. Pat, who struck you sober? How did you get in these rooms? Did you have any knowledge of AA? Did you have any knowledge of this big book? Did you have any knowledge of these steps? Did you have any experience with these steps, turning statements into questions and finding out your truth? I go, no, not a lick. And yet here you are, Pat. How do you account for the fact that you could not stay away from the drink because of the mental obsession, and you couldn't control the drink once you drank, the physical allergy, and that spiritual malady was all over you like a wet blanket? How do you experience and how do you explain the fact that you're sober? And I said, God's doing for me, Bill, what God I couldn't do for myself. It's a fact. And I started having faith because I started having God experience. And then he takes me through the four step. I'll hurry up, Joanne. I'll finish off here. Like 2 minutes? Do I have 2 minutes? 1 minute? 2 minutes. Okay, good. So I go into this four step. I do these three inventories. I get a new sexual ideal. I start seeing the fact that I'm the root of my problems. I start seeing the fact that I'm selfish, self-centeredness, that's the root of the spiritual malady. I start experiencing for the first time that I'm in the delusion that other people in this world to serve me. And I start to see the delusion coming real, which is I'm the author of my own problems, not them. And then I'm trying to make everybody do what I want them to do for me so I could be okay. And they, even if they did it perfectly, could never do enough. And I found that objectionable. And I found that I didn't want to cling to these things anymore. And there's a lot more. We don't have time to talk about it. But I go into a step 5, 6, and 7 experience. And my 6 experience was unbelievable because I didn't want to hold on to any of these things anymore. I wanted God to remove it all from me. I didn't want any of that stuff. And so when I got to my step seven prayer, I'm going, my creator, God, please remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness. Everything is good. Everything is bad. I don't even know what that means anymore. But whatever it is that's blocking me off from you, do it. I'm open. Go for it. And then I go into an 8 and 9. And you know what? It took me 7-8 years to get through all my amends. But I'm here to tell you, I've done all my amends, every single one. And some of them were heart-wrenching, and some of them were painstaking. That's a whole meeting in and of itself. And then 10 says, and Bill said to me, and I'm closing off now. He said, Pat, your job now is to grow in the spiritual realm that you find yourself in. You are going to grow in understanding in your relationship with God so God could use you in bigger ways, because your maximum service to God and your people about you is your purpose. And the irony is, Pat, you're going to find out that doing the will of God is good for you. It's satisfying for you, and it creates wholeness in your life. And folks, I'm here to tell you it does. And so I pursue like a man, like a dog, my spiritual practices in step 11. I've never not been doing my spiritual practice step 11 since I went through this work for the plus 20 plus years, folks. I do all four parts of step 11 practice. I do an active 10th step during the day. I have 10 step buddies that I actually do the 10th step with. I watch. I ask God to remove. I discuss with somebody immediately. I make amends quickly. I do resolutely turn my attention to someone that I can help. Yes, I do. You know why? Because love and tolerance is my code. And I pray every day for my wife that I would be shown how to be patient, tolerant, kind, and loving to my wife. You know why? Greatest gift God ever gave me is my third marriage. And we have been true to one another, no cheating, no nothing. And I love her more today than I did 18 years ago. And we're celebrating 18 years. And I love you guys. And if we can't give this away, this program, these 12 steps, and sponsor actively, then we haven't tasted the good stuff of this deal. I love you guys. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Pat, for sharing with us tonight. We really appreciate